Speaking of strong, we have Larry with us. How are you, Larry?
I'm great, man. I'm feeling good. A little stomach's weak for some reason, but other than that, I'm good.
Okay, you sound great. And Kirk, it's been at least 3 hours since we were together.
At least 3 hours, but we're back at it. That's good.
We're back at it. Yeah, we're going to pick up right where we left off. You guys have anything you would like to introduce before we jump into Proverbs 6? We're going to start with Proverbs 6 complete, our review of it, and then we're going to move into Psalm 91. Roy, I think, listens to the archives of this program. Roy had sent me Proverbs 7 because it's related to the whore that is introduced in Proverbs 6, and I've just finished translating it. So after we've completed Psalm 91, we're going to move to Proverbs 7. I do want to just one little teaser, and then see if you guys have anything you'd like to introduce before we get started. Proverbs 7, after addressing the nature of the whore and of explaining the deadly nature of the whore, introduces a singular name in association with the whore's plague of death. Now, Kirk, you already know that name because I spilled the beans a few hours ago. But Larry, what do you think the name is? There's one name that the whole psalm, the whole proverb goes all the way to the end. And at the end, the nature of the whore, and this is the whore of Babylon, is identified with a name. Whose name do you think that might be?
I'm going to guess Ashura.
No, actually, I would have thought Ashura would have been a good candidate, but no, somebody you dislike more than Ashura, more than Astarte. Pardon?
Paulos.
Well, actually, it wasn't Paulos. It was Paulos, but by his guest, Shaul.
Sheol. Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another. We have another Sheol sighting.
I've seen that at the end. The little. The lowly and little. Yeah.
Yeah, but at this time, rather than using his Latin given name as Paulos, lowly and little, it actually has Sheol right there, bigger than life.
Yep. Once again.
Right.
I had a guy today on a post tell me that, believe this or not, I was in Shannon Graham's group, and the guy said that the Torah proves Paul through Torah codes.
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah. Well, ignore.
I said, well, he outright outs him, too. Maybe you didn't know that. And, you know, I just.
Yeah, it does. Outright outs him, calls him the plague of death. We'll ignore the fact that Paul condemned and annulled the Torah. That would be really interesting. So the Torah codes confirm Paul, even though Paul said that the Torah was pornography and that he was annulling it. So wouldn't he annul
the... Yeah, and the people under the Torah should be castrated, and on it goes, surely.
Yeah.
He's just a good guy,
after all. That believe the Enoch calendar obviously have never read Enoch. Those who proclaim that there are Torah codes that didn't burn Paul. I mean, Paul is according to God, the plague of death. He is the biggest piece of crap. The most disgusting human who ever lived. There is no one on the planet in the history of humankind that God despises more than Paul. And so if you're thinking that the Torah advocates him, you have to be a complete moron. That's just astounding.
Yeah. Nobody's killed more of the family. Nobody's probably killed more people. Nobody's helped establish a more monstrous matrix within the government. I think it's a combination of all those things. Mm-hmm. He is just a straight up, you know, Nimrod, period.
He is the, from God's perspective, Shaul, known as the wannabe Apostle Paul, self-proclaimed Apostle Paul, is the single most loathsome, despicable, hated abomination of all of human history. And you know what's interesting is that you would think that the most hated individual would be the person that Christians misname the Antichrist, the Torahless one. Mm-hmm. And yet Paul is the prototype for him. Paul is worse than the Torahless one. Paul wrote the script for the Torahless one.
Yeah, he did. It's not only that. I mean, the Torrellis one gets involved in a lot of, you know, a lot of a power grab and certainly the murder of billions of people. But it wouldn't have been possible without Sheol. And
no.
And he has killed billions already. From a spiritual standpoint, which is all that really counts anyway.
There are 2.2 billion Christians alive today. Throughout history, there have been another 2 billion. So all total, there's 4.5 billion souls that have been led to their demise, death, and destruction because of Paul. There is... His name appears everywhere, and everywhere God either associates him with the plague of death or the seductive, deceitful, and deadly nature of the whore of Babylon. There is no one that God is more angry with. They spend more time exposing and condemning. And, you know, I figure that if we follow Yahweh's example, if what he thinks is important to say, if we think is important to say, we're in pretty good shape.
Thanks,
sir. And you know what, too? You can't just consider the 4.2 billion. And here's why. You know, people that go out and they associate, as an example, with Christmas, you know, this is really brought about again by, you know, a society by and large buying into Apollos. And there's plenty of people who are not Christian that put Christmas trees up. You know, I grew up in a secular household.
Is universally celebrated. Even among non-Christians.
Yeah, sure. Easter egg hunts, all these things, mm-hmm. the fertility rites, you know, obviously is what that entails. But, you know, as you look at, and then you have all the people that you know, made a mockery out of Yahweh's words. I mean, when you and the rest of us look at Yahweh's words and we see them in a very straightforward manner, the warnings, this is what's going to happen, this is when it's going to happen. It turns out all of it happened exactly when he said it would happen, exactly in the past.
Yeah. You know, even people who take, you know, who work 6 days a week that are not Christians, guess what day they take off?
Always
Sunday.
Sunday. Yeah. Sunday.
But even the perpetration, who the perpetrators are, all this just happens to work out exactly the way Yahweh said it would thousands of years ago. But all these things are covered up due to Paul. So what has he done? He's helped create atheists, hasn't he? I mean, really, the whole religious notion that's so popular, when somebody sits back and actually analyzes it, it becomes a little goofy.
Yeah. And there's a lot of the basis of socialist secular humanism in Gnosticism, the Greek philosophical and religious bent that is so popular today in socialist secular humanism. And Paul's letters are purely Gnostic. So, yeah, I think Paul is to blame for really all of the corruption other than the... You know, millions of people, but less than 10 million people on the planet, so an inconsequential number that are involved in Judaism. That's Akiba and Maimonides. They get the blame for that. And Paul had no influence on Hinduism, Confucianism, or Buddhism. And so there's about a billion, too, that he is not responsible for there.
Other than he may have borrowed concepts from them, because Gnosticism really does, you know. I mean, it's kind of the
inculcation. So I think he is, your point is, that there are, 2.4 billion Christians and another 1 billion socialist secular humanists. And Paul is largely, totally responsible for one group and largely responsible for the other group.
Yes. So you got to
more than half the world population has been deceived, and has ingested the plague of death because of that despicable man, which is why God has so much to say about him.
Yeah, well, don't overlook the European empires and the U.S. empire, all the way from Rome, for that matter. Their wars, and then
that grew out of the Roman Empire. You know, God said that of human empires, the worst was Rome, but that there would be a beast that would grow out of the Roman Empire that was far more deadly and would persist right until his return. Didn't he say that it would come from a little and lowly horn?
Yeah, he said it'll come from little. Yeah, I read that. Yeah, and that is laughable. You're right.
Yeah.
I mean, that makes him a Pauline Christian. That's lowly and little again. Just like when Shamuel looked at King Sheol and looked at him and said, you know, I know you find yourself lowly and little.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't that wild? I mean, that's really wild stuff. So one serves as the archetype for the next, you know, right up to the end, which is why, as you point out, Raquel said that, you know, she knew she had a beast inside of her, and then along comes Benjamin, you know, wow.
Yeah.
How can all these things be overlooked? Do they think that Yah was just writing these books just to give us names for no reason and they're not connected to anything at all? I mean, really?
Yeah, we talked about it for the first half an hour on observations today about that there's only one way to know Yah. There's only one way to engage in a relationship with him. There's only one way to enjoy his company. And that's through evidence and reason. You have to observe the words that he provided in his Torah and prophets, closely examine, carefully consider them, and use reason, thought, contemplation to appreciate what he is saying and who he is and what he is offering and how we engage. That is the only way that we can get to know him. And he specifically presented his testimony in such a way that it invites this kind of examination and contemplation. It was done for a reason. This is what he enjoys. It's what he is presenting to us. And so
I've
the
said
answer
it before,
to your question
I'll say
is
it
no.
Again.
He presented all these details specifically so we could learn in this way.
Yeah, can you imagine? Can you imagine? Let's say you're an active participant in Judaism, okay?
Uh-huh.
And you name and you claim the Torah, which you do not know, and a God that you do not know. For the you know,
right.
if you're involved in Judaism, yeah, and you name your child Benjamin, or you name your child Sheol.
Yeah.
What the hell are you doing exactly? Did you just miss that entire part or what?
Right.
Where does Yahweh
what are you doing?
Raise up Sheol? Where? Does he say King Sheol is this great guy?
All are their children.
Well, yeah, that too. But see, they're reading their New Testament. I can see where they're, you know, just stupefied. But I'm talking about you're in the meat of the Torah. What does Yahweh say that's good about King Sheol?
Nothing. I mean, he goes on for for a page of just ranting. I says, this is what this guy's going to bring in. It's nothing but death and grief and thievery and taxation and abuse. And
he's going to use your children as military
weapons.
He's going to
create armies. He's going to have them march and kill and die for him, and then he's going to tax you some more, and he's going to build a bigger army, and he's going to equip his army with more and more weapons, and he's going to deploy them, and it's going to cost you everything. That's what God says.
Sounds familiar to me.
That sounds extraordinary.
You know.
Yeah, just
yeah, but why would you
make
you picture this? Let's say you're involved in Judaism. You claim the Torah. You know all about King Sheol. And what do you do now? You name your child after him? What in the hell are you thinking?
Well, you know, I think the problem there is that religious Jews are not Torah observant. Their Torah
no,
is really the Talmud. Yeah, and it's the
they're
Talmud.
Tradition people, too.
Yeah, they're into the Talmud. They say they're Torah observant, but they pay no attention to the Torah. They are Talmud observant, and then they refer to the Talmud as the oral
as the Torah.
And so it's the oral Torah, and so that is what they are fixated on.
And well, their story is, in the debates I've had, you can't understand the Torah without the Talmud. And I say, wow.
So what you're saying is that God is a traffic communicator. Your God cannot communicate. Your God needs rabbis to communicate. That's not the God I know. So the God who is capable of creating DNA, the God who is capable of authoring the Torah, is a crappy communicator. And you can't understand him apart from some religious interpretation.
Yeah, that's where they went to
how could you be so stupid? I know. That is their whole deal. But how could you be so stupid? Why would you want to spend your eternity with a god that's incapable of being understood?
Good point. Good point.
Why would you trust a god that can't communicate?
Yeah.
You know, if you get right back to Paul, why would you believe a god who said, my plan is inadequate, it failed, because either I'm a lousy communicator, a lousy planner, or a lousy executor, so I hired this guy to, who's really a despicable son of a bitch, but I hired him to, and appointed him to fix it all for me. I mean, isn't that the argument of the Talmud?
Yes. So
you can't trust God, you can't understand God. So, you know, he appointed us to explain all this to you.
And for $19.95, we will send you the cassette.
So long as you acquiesce to our authority.
Form, yeah.
Okay. Oh, hell, for $500, I'll come in and bless your home. That's
right.
You do.
Yeah, even better.
It's just,
hey, what a
unbelievable.
Deal.
Yeah, I'm here to tell you. I'm just, it's just shocking to me. You know, when I first came into understanding the Torah, it was shocking to me how many Jews didn't, which is like nearly all of them, save a few that happened to be in this group.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just it was very strange for me to really be able to grasp that, because I thought, wow, if anybody knew the Torah, it must have been them. And then I come to find out through just, you know, any number of debates, and I'm sure you've had them, that none of them know the Torah. I mean, first time they say Adonai or Hashem, you know, well, they don't know the Torah at all.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. How many times does Yahweh refer to himself as Hashem?
The name, as the name. Never.
Yeah. Never. No, and how often does Yahweh refer to himself as Adonai, my Lord?
Never. Never. He does advance the idea those advancing that are completely wrong. They're going to be sorry they did it. Yeah.
Yeah, that the Lord is associated with the whore of Babylon, with Satan.
Mm-hmm.
Yahweh's instruction is that you should not genuinely or continuously covered, or find desirable her beautiful or graceful appearance in your heart. And do not let her actually obtain control of you on an ongoing basis with her flaunting display of flashing rays of light or her flirting eyes. There are, maybe 500 to 1,000 unique revelations or insights in the and between Yada Yah and Intro to God and Questioning Paul and the like. But one of the most interesting actually came along as I was writing Prophet of Doom, which is I was trying to understand in Prophet of Doom why it was that the Quran speaks negatively of Satan when it's obvious that Allah is Satan. Allah spends all of his time in hell. Allah desires to be worshipped. He wants to be the Lord. He wants people to fear him. It is obvious that Allah is Satan, and yet the Quran besmirches Satan. And so,
and
you
begin to realize that he hides in religion, and that's what led to this.
That's exactly right. That Satan doesn't want to be known as Satan. He doesn't want to be worshipped as Satan, because Satan is the adversary. He doesn't want to be the adversary. Yahshua, Isaiah 14, explains exactly what Satan wants. He wants to be seen as God, above God. And so the only way that Satan can achieve his desire, which is to be seen as above God, is he has to be the Lord of religion. And so Satan goal is to fool people into believing that he is God. And the more beautiful the trappings, the more majestic the surroundings, the more likely it is that people are going to view the Lord of Christianity, the Lord of the Allah of Islam, and the Hashem of Judaism. The more beautiful the surroundings, the more godly the appearance, the more Satan achieves what he's looking to achieve, which is to be
that's one of the reasons I think
worship as God.
told us to tear all those pillars down, destroy all those beautiful buildings underneath
and
the shade trees.
The profound insight, the moment that you recognize that it's, that occultic worship, that's not Satanism. Satanism is Christianity. Satanism is Islam.
Yeah. I've been telling people this for years.
Right. But it's it is a profound insight that that I came to is I was reading Morals and Dogma, which in Morals and Dogma is Pike, who wrote Morals and Dogma on behalf of Freemasonry, on behalf of Adam Weishaupt. And he was presenting the what a 33rd degree Mason would see after they've finally been told who their God is. And they're being told that their God is Lucifer, the light bearer, who does not want to be known as Satan, the adversary. And there it was. And
you know,
when you recognize that,
God,
and you see it from the perspective
right,
of this proverb, God is saying exactly the same thing. Satan is seductive because Satan never presents himself as Satan, as the adversary. Always presents himself as the Lord of religion.
Yeah, I'll tell you an interesting story, and this is going on, you know, right here. Yalda let me know that tomorrow she's going down with her friends. Of course, she's, you know, Ronnie, and they're going down to Daytona Beach tomorrow to have a really good time for, guess what? The New Year. No ruse. You know, based on what? Sun worship. And I told her, you shouldn't do this. This is bad news and all the rest. And, of course, she informed me that, well, you know, but it's not, we're not religious. You know us. We're not a religious event. You know, we're going down there to have fun and dance and eat kebab and blah, blah, blah. And I said, yeah, I'm aware of that. And I said, and people at Christmas time have warm, fuzzy feelings and they eat dinner together and they hand each other presents. I said, that's the point, isn't it?
Man is really screwed up. This the whore has been unbelievably successful. It's woven it in the very fabric of culture. So it's how people feel good is to envelop themselves in all of this. But here, as Yan was saying, don't find her desirable. The fact that she has a graceful, she has an attractive, a desirable appearance, and it's one of the great ironies is to realize that the devil, Satan, is not unattractive, and that the devil never wants you to worship him as the devil. He wants you to worship him as God. And, you know, I even have trouble every time I say that. Guys, I cringe because when you say Satan wants you to worship him as God, that makes it sound like God wants to be worshipped. God doesn't want to be worshipped. Satan does. Now, we talk today and say all the time that a God that wants to be worshipped isn't worth knowing. That's a despicable entity. You know, and a God that would create an inferior being to worship him is disgusting. So what is Satan? When Satan wants to be worshipped, bowed down to in religion, it conveys the fact that Satan is insecure. Satan is disgusting. Anyone that wants to be worshipped is pathetic. They're revolting. And every time I go by a Christian church and it says worship service, you just want to puke. You want to grab the pastor and strangle him. And I know that, like, you know, sometimes a politician is there, I'll punch him in the face. And I'm not a violent person. But I tell you, I just want to vomit all over him. What do you mean, worship service? What kind of a disgusting God are you trying to present around here?
When you go in there on Sunday and you worship a Lord in front of the oldest satanic cross in the world, the cross, you are worshiping who they call Lucifer, but it's really Halal Ben Shakar. And it's all encapsulated in his name, isn't it?
Right.
I mean, really.
That's why God says, don't be fooled. Don't do this. You know, the most beautiful buildings, the most grand edifices are built to religion. Your religion has this special stigma of being, you know, spectacular. But so does politics. And you know, the The god of
talk show host.
Politics is every bit as disgusting.
But one of your former neighbors out there in California, I was telling somebody how disgusting she is. Oprah.
Oprah, yeah.
You know, what does she have to say? You know, what did this person say to me? One of the people involved in the conversation. Oh, but she's got money. Oh, okay.
So, yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure what the hell that means. There's serial killers throughout history that had money and power.
Psalm 91, which we get into Psalm 91. I take Psalm 91 as being wholly and completely personal. I think God wrote it for me. Now, but when I say that, I'm not being egotistical here, because I think he wrote it for Kirk and for Larry and for JB and for everyone listening to this program.
But that is one aspect
of it, the fact that he wrote it for me. And one of the things that it says is, you know, I want to make sure you're wealthy. I want you to be wealthy. And there's a reason. It provides a liberty to invest time doing this sort of thing. Now, it's wealth if you're an Oprah and that is all you got, then that's not so good. Then it's a negative. But if you have it and you use it so that you can now devote your time to not only studying what God said but sharing it, then it's a positive.
Yeah, but we're right back to somebody surrounded by beautiful trappings and buildings.
Oh, of course.
Wonderful ways.
Oh, you can see her. You know, she sits on, you know, in a community where an acre of land is worth $3 million. She sits on 50 acres and has all manner of extravagant buildings. And when she goes back and forth to her other home, she flies in a Global Express, a $75 million airplane.
Wow.
Who knows how much,
millions
of dollars the Montecito estate is. She was my neighbor. She's no longer my, I actually looked down on her from my property in Montecito, but I sold it. So it's, and I had a bungalow by comparison.
How perfect is that? You looked down
yeah.
on her. I like that.
Yeah.
I like
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
And you should have, too.
So don't covet. Don't find desirable her beautiful appearance in your heart. And do not let her obtain control of you on an ongoing basis. Now, the ongoing basis here, the fact it was written in the imperfect, that's really helpful. I don't know how helpful it is for you, Larry, but it's probably helpful for you because you were one time really political. And I know, Kirk, you and I, it's really helpful because we were one time religious.
Religious.
So what he's saying is, you know, you can be religious, and we can still get along, so long as you don't stay religious.
Yeah.
You know, if you're willing to come out of religion, we can get along just great. And that's what he meant when he said, don't let her, on an ongoing basis, have control of you. He doesn't say you can never be influenced by it. I was.
Sure.
He said, don't continue with it. So long. In fact, I actually think there is a huge advantage of having been religious, of having been political, of having been patriotic. Because when you leave that stuff, rather than missing it, God, I loathe it. But I know it.
Oh, you and I
were both.
What is it about? We were both patriotic. We were both patriotic. I know that.
Big fact.
You were a constitutionalist, and so was I. And so when I sat and I listen to people today go on about this needs to happen. We need to elect this person. We need to elect that person. I asked them, and what damn good has it ever done you?
Right.
And the answer is it hasn't.
It's
for some reason they just can't find anybody out there that understands the word freedom.
No, and you know it's interesting. The guy that's running that would be the most constitutional is the most dishonest, Cruz. He is the most Christian. He's the most dishonest, and he's the most constitutionalist of the current candidates. And so, for somebody to say we need somebody who really will uphold the Constitution, then what you're going to have is an abject liar. I mean, Cruz is a lying piece of crap. I can't. Back of the, what is it, there's four running on the Republican side and two on the Democratic side. Of those six, the most despicable by far is Cruz.
I'm so far away from this stuff, I have totally stayed away from it.
I know you are. There's a legacy of shattering myths that sticks with me that I still read my 12 newspapers a day. Just because I don't talk about it doesn't mean that I love to chew on it and spit it out. So excuse me for going there. But
yeah. Try to eat the chicken and spit out the bones, and it's a lot of bones. I do know this. I know that I was surprised because it just a commercial came on showing that what's his name, Donald Trump, was leading the pack, and I was like, wow. And the ad was so disingenuous, like he's an outsider.
Oh yeah, well he is an outsider from a political point of view. He's just not an outsider from a establishment point of view. I mean, he's But anyway. One interesting thing here is it says, don't let her fool you with her flaunting display of flashing rays of light. Yosha described Hasatan, Satan's departure from heaven. How did he describe it?
Same way, light.
Flashing light.
Flashing light. Yeah, Paul described his meeting with his spiritual friend on the road to Damascus. How did he describe it?
Flashing light, like a lightning bolt. Right. Blinded
right. Now, okay. Now, it's interesting here. This is where you really got to think. And I know that in this group, thinking is something we value, we appreciate, we understand, we enjoy. It's not something that most people like to do. But Yahweh equates himself to light. What's the difference between flashing light and the light of Yahweh?
The light's eternal. It's solid. It's there. It illuminates.
Never goes out. Never blinks.
Yahweh doesn't come and go, and Yahweh is not flashy. God is the antithesis of flashy. He's steady. He's dependable. He is who he is. He does not change. He is always brilliant. He is never diminished. He doesn't go from light to dark as lightning does. He just is, and he's the antithesis of flashy. God is, the thing that makes God so cool is that he's not flashy. I'm as dented and flawed and dirty as they come. And you know something? I don't feel uncomfortable around him. It made me feel really welcome. Because he's not flashy. He's not ostentatious. He is just a great guy. And he's always consistent. So Satan is flashy. Pretends to be what he isn't. You know, this is... Satan is, first of all, he is a malach, which means he's comprised of light. But his light is inconsistent. That's why it makes it flashy, as opposed to solid, which is what Yahweh is, always brilliant. You know, you don't
good
read
point.
The Torah, Prophets, and Psalms and find some parts that are, boy, this is really good stuff. And then you read some and say, oh, boy, this is really not so good here. This must have been an off moment.
No, he's consistently straightforward with what he presents, and it's always correct, and it's always right. And that's, you know what, for the creator of the universe, I mean, think about this job. You know, we all know about fulfilling the Moed. Think about this job. Handing these words out through people who basically, most of them knew they were going to be killed, and they did it anyway. And passing these words on to this dimension from another dimension. There's a trick.
True flawed implements. Yeah, true flawed implements. God chose to convey his testimony through flawed. He liked working through flawed implements. Now, he doesn't like working just through a flawed instrument for the sake of it being flawed. Although he likes that from the sense it makes him look good. And it also, by when you're working with somebody who knows they have issues, like we all know we have issues, it creates the right level of dependence upon God, which I think is a really good thing. But God really enjoys working through people. And yes, he, from the seventh dimension, created into our little three-dimensional corner of his universe through flawed individuals. And we ought not ever diminish the importance of that. That God, who could have communicated all of this in absolute perfection and given it to us on a USB memory stick,
With a booming voice on top of Mount Everest.
Could have been on the top of Mount Everest. He could have been a brilliant, perfect light with a booming voice and given it all to us. What he said is, no, I'm not going to do that. The reason I'm going to do that is severalfold. And the most important reason isn't just because if I did that, I would be negating the whole idea of choice, because there's no way to deny me if I'm in your face like that. That's not the number one reason he did it that way. You know what the number one reason that God chose to communicate through a guy with a speech impediment like Moshe, decided to write the most brilliant of Psalms through a guy that had all sorts of issues like Dode? Why did he decide to do that? Why did he create his ultimate declaration to the Gentile world through a kid? Just a kid. And Yirmiyah. Why did he choose to do that?
I think it was because it denoted he had to have a relationship with those flawed implements. And that relationship.
That's fun for him. That's the entire reason he created the universe, was to do that.
Yeah.
He made Moshe brilliant. He made Dode brilliant. He enjoyed the give and take. He loved the fact that he could communicate. You know, I always wondered, why does the body exist? Torah, Prophets, and Psalms is all narrated in first person. Yahweh's voice, until you get to Dabadim. Dabadim isn't first person, it's in Moshe's voice. Why did that happen? Why? Because that's the whole purpose.
Shares.
God revealed his Torah teaching to Moshe. Moshe got it. He understood it. He was put in a position where he said, let me explain this to you. The whole idea. You know what we're doing here? When we read something God says and we talk about it? That's the body. The whole purpose of it. You know, some people say, you know, why can't you just do the translations and not write all this commentary? Because the purpose of what he communicated was for us to think about it and extrapolate and understand and find the insights and the connections. It's the whole purpose of it.
Well, let me ask
you. You're denying the entire purpose of it if you don't have this discussion.
Let me answer that. We just went over three words. Yofi, we know, is beauty. But it also has a little sneaky meaning of miracles and signs and wonders exposing, you know. We have...
Flashing.
Yes, flashing. We have... in the clock, we have flashing lights, of course, and that exposes Paul and his road to Damascus.
Yeah. Paul constantly claimed to be doing miracles, signs, and wonders, and that was the proof that he was divinely inspired. The one that does the signs and wonders, Satan, he's the flashy one. God's not flashy.
And you also have, where it says gather, it also means snatching away to gain possession of seizing, which is snatching away is the same as Paul's description of...
our puzzle, the rapture.
Also, they're snatching away like the wolves. They snatch away and divide it up at dinner or divide it up at night.
Yeah,
so, I mean,
exactly
that's why you can't write it simply.
No.
Nothing else. It's just too many things you can glean from this that you'd miss otherwise.
Yeah, you take all the fun out of it.
Sure.
That's the voyage of discovery. That's the part that's fun. And that, by the way, is a translated Psalm 91. That's what God's constantly saying. That's the fun part. That's how we're going to work together. He's not coy about it. He told us, put it right out there in simple words for us to understand. So, for indeed, this is really interesting. For indeed, the price of the loathed female whore is just as much as an everlasting loaf of bread. But a woman or a man's soul that she stalks and eternally victimizes is extraordinarily valuable. So, you know, you can buy inclusion into one of Satan's schemes by going to Bass, by taking that wafer that's comes out of that special box that's supposed to be the body of God, which God says don't do that. If it were really the flesh of man, God said don't touch it. and to drink the blood, been transformed to the blood. God says, don't do that either. But, you know, you go and you go participate, and all of a sudden, you know, you're accepted in Roman Catholicism. You've participated in the Eucharist. You've gone to Mass. And God says, yeah, you can please the whore with a piece of bread. But the soul that she sucks. No, that could have been eternal. That is valuable. So you're sacrificing the most valuable thing in the universe, your soul. Trifle of a religious ritual.
You know, that's also the meaning of coin. Is that why coins are circle? Because of the sun god?
Yeah, probably. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's
no reason.
The hardest thing for us to actually stamp out would be circles.
Yeah.
Much easier to stamp out squares, but sure.
Squares, little bits, or whatever.
Yeah, coins are always in circles. It's got to be the symbol of the sun. That is indeed it. So these whore here is, she stalks something that is, and victimizes something that is extraordinarily valuable. That would be your soul. Can a man constantly, consistently scoop up or continually carry away fire in his lap or in his deceitful garments and not be burned by the serpent? God says, you know, you can probably, and I've been singed by religion and politics. There was a period of my life where I was really disappointed that I fell so fully for such stupidity. And so I was singed by it. Larry, my guess is that it doesn't bother you anymore. It doesn't bother me anymore either. I actually look at it as an advantage, not a disadvantage, having been political and religious, because now I know what I left and how disgusting it was and how much better what we have is than what we had previously clung to. So I'm glad we did it. But, you know, after a while, it will send you to the point that there's nothing left. And so God says, you're going to play with fire, you're going to get burnt. You're going to play with religion, it'll cost you your soul. You know, you're going to play religious dress-up, it's going to eat you alive. You know, if you're going to play religious dress-up, you're never going to get out of that whorehouse. The whorehouse of religious dress-up. Every time, there was a picture of Israel the other day, talking about the mythical people in the Palestinians and their murderous behavior. And the solution is the two-state solution, of course, which is just the opposite of a solution. And they showed, the Jew they showed was a Shah who was wearing the little black hat. And he'd just say, well, he just dressed up. And it just go, oh, I'm going to barf. But you see a woman, you know, wearing her Islamic shawl. He's going to scream. So you're going to play religious dress-up to a guy that was a rapist and a pedophile, a sexual pervert. Oh, now there's a smart woman.
The
woman that was at the Christian college, and she said the God of the Bible and the God of the Quran are the same for the Christian college. Fired her. Now, it's true that the God of the New Testament, the God of the Quran, are one and the same. But she said the God of the Bible, and while the Bible is a pagan term, and God would never use the term, 80% of the Bible that they're carrying around is the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, and Yahweh and Allah are the opposite ones. Yahweh is God, and Allah is Satan. And so the Christian college, they fired her. You know, she ended up getting a job under under an Islamic scholarship at the University of Virginia. And she's this Christian that wears a headscarf.
I know who you're talking about now. Yeah, she is.
And he's just going, God. I mean, there's just no wonder that God says, you know, I looked around the world. I wanted to find somebody that I could communicate with and through. I didn't find anybody. Hi. Lies and liars are considered in academia to be extraordinary. Truth tellers, no, not so much. Or can an individual continually walk upon the burning coals or the flashing light from the sky and his feet not be scorched?
What? The what?
The flashing light from the sky.
Oh,
Pauline
boy.
Christianity. And, of course, the coals, walking on coals for much of human history was one of the proofs of religious faith. So it has a new and an old, but it's going to get you, and you reach a point. Most people reach a point of no return, where it's impossible for them to give up religion, no matter how, no matter who they quote or who's quoted to them. And you do it all the time, Larry, where you're constantly quoting Yahweh's testimony, and the religious people. Runs right off their backs. They're impervious to God's testimony. And God's saying, eventually, you're going to be so religious that I can't help you. That's why he's saying,
I had a woman this week that continually, kept liking my posts. So I did a couple posts on her page. And one of them I pointed out, where Bible comes from and what root word it shares and what Babel means and what Biblos is.
Right.
And right along with the quote from Dabarim where, it talks about anybody that claims to speak for me and puts the names of pagan gods in my mouth, they'll wish that they could die. Which is, there you go, Sheol. She said, well, I believe, and this is what she started out with, I believe that Yahweh originally was called Amun-Ra, and Lord, and on and on. But Satan tried to usurp him. And from that point on, he only wanted to be called Yahweh. And I said, well, you are an ass. I mean, I said, we're going to cut ties here because anybody who's delusional you cannot be helped, basically.
God made an absolute, made an absolute mockery of the gods of Egypt. And the god of Egypt at the time that Yahweh said, your gods are for shit. They're absolute useless rubbish and fake. And the god of Egypt at the time he did that was Amun-Ra.
And people just dream this stuff up. They go to bed at night and they just dream this stuff up. And then they put it out there like they've had a big revelation. I'm not kidding you.
When Yahweh said that Yahweh is my name, it's the only name that I want to be remembered as and the only name I want recited, and a god by any other name is a false god. And he communicated that in Hebrew, which is always true in the past, the present, and future.
Mm-hmm.
How does that give any possibility for this woman's proposition?
Obviously, it doesn't, not even a little bit. You wouldn't even have to know that. All you'd have to do is read his words, and you'd walk away going, whoa. No, he was never called Amun-Ra. He's got no respect for Amun-Ra. It'd be like calling you Joe Shit the Ragman. Would you like that? Every time somebody said
Yada,
you mean Joe Shit.
Joe Shit, you're all you're doing is defaming somebody who is nothing but another fellow human being.
Right.
It's another thing entirely to cast aspersions on God and to
it's much worse. You're right.
Yeah.
infinitely
different. You can cast aspersions on me. So what? It's meaningless. But you cast aspersions on the creator of the universe. While he may not react to you because you're just trash, you're not worth him reacting to you.
Well, he's not even listening to you. He doesn't even care.
Right. But you can be assured that when you do that, you have zero chance of ever entering his home. Therefore, in likeness.
Well, there's another side to that, too. And that's when these people say these things. And let's say her name was Jill. And I said, well, I'm going to start calling you Butch. You ought to see how upset they get at that.
Yeah.
I mean, they really get upset that their name has been changed from Jill, as an example, to Butch.
Yeah.
It bothers them. And I say, well, why does that bother you? What the hell's the big deal, Butch? Come on, man. I am not Butch. What are you calling me? I said, well, I guess I could call you a lesbian. I could call you Butch.
Yeah.
I could call you anything you want. Doesn't make much difference to me. Why?
Right.
Does that bother you? right?
So
and
you're uncomfortable with that, but you're comfortable changing God's name.
Mm-hmm. That's how big
a
hypocrite
for you.
They all are. They're total hypocrites, every one of them.
Right.
It's funny.
Yeah, and my view is, I really don't care what you call me. Yeah, I can call me anything you want. It has zero influence on me. I don't even call you, even if you want to call me by the most derogatory, disgusting name in the world, I'm going to laugh. I really don't care. But when it comes to Yahweh, I care a lot. He cares a lot. That's a whole different kettle of fish. You know, he's important. We're not, but your point is made. Therefore, in life,
I don't even think it's he's saying, look at me, I'm important, as much as he's saying, you know, there's so much, you know, religion and all this other nonsense associated with Amun-Ra and Lord and Allah and all the Buddha and all the rest of the garbage out there that, you know, to him, the ignorance, the, you know, the preposterous nature, the cartoon-like vision of religion is so abhorrent to him. I mean, he wants to be greeted as an individual, and he's saying, I have a name, and I'm an individual, and that's just how I want to be known as an individual.
Yeah, I think that's, personally, I think that's
a great part
that half of it. That half of it is the fact that he is, that the distinction between calling God different names, the Lord, Jesus Christ, Shiva, Allah, that calling him by different names and then proclaiming that there are different paths and different that all religions lead to him and that we all worship the same God. The distinction between those concepts is incredibly small. And so half of the reason that he doesn't want to be known by any other God, by any other name, is because that the whole notion of the God of every religion being the same is repugnant to him. It is untrue, and so the distinction of, I only have one name, and if you're not using that name, if you do not know that name, you do not know me. You have been deceived. I think that's half of it. The other half of it is...
Oh, straight-up respect.
Yeah, straight-up respect.
Two.
If I've given you my name 7,000 times, if I told you that there is nothing more important than knowing my name and that demeaning my name, causing my name to be for naught, is unforgivable. If you don't want to be associated with my name, then you're not going to exist. That's the relation part.
You can't even make the connections without the name. No. I mean, you really can't.
Can't understand who he is, what he's offering. How to engage with him. His name is essential. And he says it over and over again. So this is not us extrapolating. This is what he has to say.
In fact, when you finally get to 91, I did a quick, I'm doing them line by line now, but and then I'll compare them to what you wrote before I get too deep involved in. But the coolest thing I found was the very end of it when he talks about you get all these blessings because, you remember?
Yeah.
Because
you know my name. Yeah, you know my name. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. It's extraordinarily powerful. The end, but the whole thing is powerful. It's a real treasure, and I'm going to present it personally. But as we're presenting it personally, I want everybody to personalize it for themselves. All right, so as we make our way through the end of this, therefore and likewise, the one who goes to and pursues this evil female, who is his immoral country's woman, he will not be pardoned nor seen as innocent, including all who make contact. They're plagued by her. God is saying as clearly as words allow, if you're religious, then you're dead. If you're going to play religion, if you're going to play politics, if you're going to play patriotism, you are plagued, you are dead, you are diseased. I've got nothing to do with you. You have ingested a poison that I cannot resolve. God is saying that he cannot save a religious individual. So the Terms
and there's another thing here that there's another thing there that needs to be pointed out. He uses that word plague again there, you know, and over in Chabawook, he calls Paul the plague of death. I mean, since we're talking about lightning, you know, and
he calls Shaul the plague of death in Yashayah. He calls Paul the plague of death in Hosea. He calls Paul the plague of death in the Proverbs. He's constantly calling Paul the plague of death.
Yeah.
Yeah, the first
I've
time.
Found it so many times now, it's scary.
It's just all over the place.
Yeah,
Proverbs 7 ends by calling Shaul the plague of death. So, if you're going to be plagued by this, you're going to die. That's one of the most amazing things is that religion is promoted as that which saves. You know, Muslims say unless you accept Muhammad as Allah's prophet and state the confession of Islam and acquiesce to Allah, that you're going to roast in hell. And Christians claim that unless you have prayed the sinner's prayer or become a member of the Catholic Church, that you're going to go to hell, and that their religion is the only one that has the keys to heaven and that can save you. And yet God's saying here exactly the opposite. I can save you from anything, but except I can't save you from religion. That's what this line means. I cannot save you from religion. And there's a reason for that. That until you give up religion, God doesn't want you around his children because you're infectious. That would be like God owning a beautiful home and allowing rats infected with a bubonic plague to move into that home. He is not going to do it. So the most deadly plague of all of human history is religion. God's not going to allow that plague into his home. If you are religious, he can't save you. So the very institution that claims to be the instrument of salvation is the very instrument that is the plague of death from which God cannot save. Doesn't make God impotent. It makes him compassionate. Makes him wise. Makes him
fair.
Somebody that's fair
Love
that
it.
You want to spend time with.
Yeah.
If you're going to rely on religion for your salvation, then God can't save you. You've made another choice. Don't they have contempt for, in this regard, the thief or kidnapper? He steals people or property to satisfy his soul because he is famished. No, the comparison here is that why is it you can't see that religion is stealing your soul? I mean, if a thief did it, even if the thief was hungry, you know, you'd still condemn the thief. You know, the idea of committing murder because you were angry doesn't get you exonerated. The fact that if you were to go to the court because you shoplifted $500 worth of food because you were hungry, the law still is going to hold you accountable. You stole the property. And what God said, okay, so even if the thief is hungry, society as a whole will hold that thief accountable if he steals. So what institution is the most thieving institution in the history of humankind? Religion. So why is it you don't hold religion accountable for stealing people's souls?
No. This also speaks to your famous statement, we don't hate enough.
Yeah.
What I wrote down off to the side, because we don't seem to hate these things. Why don't we hate these things?
Yeah, you know, we did a whole thing on political correctness the first half an hour today on observations for our time. And the one thing I didn't get to is that, you know, political correctness tells you that the worst thing you can do is hate, that the world needs to stamp out hate. And yet, there is no chance of compassion or of caring or of morality without hate.
You have to hate
that which is evil, that which is counterproductive, that which is deadly, that which is menacing, that which is disease-ridden. If you don't hate the rapist, there's something wrong with you. If you don't hate the pedophile, you're not moral. If you don't hate the murderer, there's something drastically wrong with your conscience. And by, for example, exonerating the religion that is responsible for 99% of the world's terrorist attacks, rather than being compassionate, it's murderous. you know, our problem is we don't hate enough. We don't know what to hate as a society because of political correctness. It's made us upside down. And if he is discovered, he will repay, making restitution sevenfold for all of the wealth of the possessions of his household. He will pay and provide. Now, as I first translated, I said, wait a minute. God has no use for money. So if somebody stole some evil corporation or, and, you know, for the most part, I don't see corporations as evil, but let's go evil corporation or evil government entity or bank or something, and they are stealing people's property. This idea that God's going to have them pay sevenfold for what they stole, that's silliness. A, that when these people are being judged by God, they're appearing penniless. They got no money to pay. And the last thing God needs or wants is money. So he's obviously not talking about money here. So what is he talking about? So as I began to analyze this, I said, okay, those who steal souls, confiscating the most valuable commodity in the universe, will be held accountable for what they have done. Therefore, while robbing the faithful has become easy for religious individuals, their recompense forfeits a crime. They exchanged a worthless promise of eternal life for tithes and offerings. But when they are judged, they will not only forfeit all of the possessions they found so desirable, including their houses of God, they will endure a sevenfold diminishment for every soul they cheated out of life.
Because they reduced to a dot.
Yeah, so this is typically, that's exactly right. That's the conclusion that I came to. I'm not claiming I'm right. But I wanted to figure this out, and that's the conclusion I came to, is that this is typically interpreted as paying back seven times the amount stolen. But since the kidnapped souls are too valuable to be monetarized, I don't think Yahweh is speaking of silver and gold, especially in the context of a final judgment. Also, since the consequence of being religious is to die, ceasing to exist, and the penalty for promoting religion is to be imprisoned in Sheol for an eternity, a sentence requiring a sevenfold time of incarceration would either be would also be nonsensical. So, here is the idea that I came up with. What if the recompense is to be diminished sevenfold? With Yahweh and his home existing in the seventh dimension, expulsion to Sheol, a singularity akin to a black hole, would serve as the ideal sentence, one befitting the crime, a sevenfold diminishment. These religious and political scoundrels rob millions of the opportunity to transcend this life and enter the seventh dimension, living with Yahweh for all time. So why not eternally dispatch them to a realm reduced to the size of a period at the end of a written sentence? Perfect.
Don't get a big head, but that was brilliant.
That was really good.
You've been hanging out with Roy, huh?
Yeah, that
was
good.
Good.
That's Roy M.
Roy, take that, Roy.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, I tell you what, though, man, right at the moment, I'm gaining a genuine appreciation from Roy, because Roy was the one that sent me to Proverbs 7. So right now I've always been a Roy fan, but I'm particularly a Roy fan. By the way, Roy did write me a letter, and I'm going to try to correct something that I said. I said that, you know, Roy is brilliant, and yet none of us are envious of him. We just all appreciate him. What Roy wrote, he says, you know, I'm not brilliant. He says, I'm just curious, and I'm diligent about my curiosity. He says, I'm constantly looking at everything and trying to figure out not only how it works, but how man can manipulate it and make it bad. And so he gave me lots of examples of how he looks at things out of curiosity and connects the dots and finds the symmetry and makes sense of things that most people don't even bother to question. And the only thing that causes him to stand out is the fact that he is constantly questioning and searching for answers and making connections to understand. And so what I wanted to, what he wanted to convey is, he says, it's not that he is brilliant, it's just that as a member of Yahweh's family, what he brings to the family is an extremely curious nature that looks to understand by making connections, by knowing and then making connections. And you know, my point was that while Roy comes up with insights in terms of dimensions and in terms of creation that exceed my capacity and probably most of our capacity to see those things, and he communicates them brilliantly so that we now can, based upon his thought processes. The fact that he is able to see and envision and understand and then convey to us so that we can understand doesn't cause anyone in the Covenant family to be jealous.
No, it's fine, probably. He never puts you down. He just explains things very well. So,
yeah, and that's the whole idea of that was to convey that the if for example, if Kirk, because of your persona, if God loves you 100 times more than he loves me, I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled. I'm the happiest guy in the world because my relationship with him is spectacular. It's just absolutely wonderful. If yours is better than mine, I'm happy.
You can't get better than perfect. Yeah, thank
you. Yeah, so you know, that's the nature of this family. You know, if Larry, you do a better job of knowing what to say, depending on what people bring up as arguments, I'm not jealous. I think it's great.
No, it's good.
You know, this is not a zero-sum game. It's not a win and lose. Roy makes a contribution that we all appreciate.
Yes, indeed.
And we're all fascinated by what he writes, by what he comes to understand. He's going to be fun to spend time with in eternity. Now, the next statement here is, actively and actually committing adultery by way of religious idolatry. So this na'af is explaining why God uses the term adultery and whore when speaking of religion, because he views committing adultery in terms of breaching the covenant as being identical with religious idolatry, that infidelity, adultery, and religious idolatry, from his perspective, they're all one and the same. And he says, so actively and actually committing adultery by way of religious idolatry and infidelity with this female individual, with the whore, is impoverishing and life-threatening, depriving the individual of good judgment, corrupting and destroying the soul of those who consistently choose to act like this. That is the conclusion that we came to 10 years ago. I became aware, and we've all witnessed this, that religious people are incapable of exercising good judgment, that religion destroys an individual's ability to think. And Yahweh, 3,000 years before we came to that conclusion by observing people's reaction to Yahweh's testimony, said it exactly this way, actively and actually committing adultery by way of religion with this female individual is impoverishing and life-threatening, depriving the individual of good judgment, corrupting and destroying those who consistently choose to act like this. Until you're willing to walk away from religion, evidence and reason mean nothing. And until you are open to evidence and reason, you have no chance whatsoever of knowing who God is, understanding what he is offering, or knowing how to capitalize upon it.
No, not even a small chance. Not even a small chance. I'd like to, you know, give you a small example. I had a friend of mine, she posted on her wall about the cross, you know, being a pagan sign. And basically what I do is I have a note about placeholders. You know, and
sure.
All the placeholders were replaced, and then they added one called Amun-Ra. Underneath this note, that is a full explanation that can be fully checked out, the guy writes, until you understand the cross, you cannot get the full benefit of it. And guess who he's quoting?
Paul.
Billy Graham.
Yeah, no, Paul. He could have quoted either one. It would have made a damn difference. But yeah.
Why don't you tell me where, before I say this, the more I study the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, which, by the way, is one thing. I say Torah, Prophets, and Psalms like there's three different things. It's one thing. Every bit of Yahweh's Torah is prophetic. Every bit of his Prophets and Psalms contains his Torah teaching. It's all one thing. I've come to the conclusion that Yosha didn't say anything that isn't written in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. And even the smallest nuance is found there. It's just, you just got to spend the time and you'll say, oh, yeah, he said that, and here it is. Where does Yahweh ever speak of the meaning, value, or purpose of an implement known as a cross?
Nowhere. It doesn't exist. He talks about his upright one.
Is there a Hebrew word for cross?
Not that I'm aware of.
No. The closest word for cross is the... isn't the implement, but instead the verb abar. The verb abar means to cross over, but it's in the sense of I'm on one side of the stream and I want to cross and go to the other side of the stream.
Like crossing over the Jordan or something.
Right, and crossing over as a verb, and the noun cross, there is no connection whatsoever. Now, Yahweh does have a term that is important to him, that has an element of a cross in it, but only one element, which is the upright portion. The Edon, which is the upright pillar of the tabernacle, and the upright one, that's an essential aspect. It's the lintels of the doorway, the upright post of the doorway, the portal to life. All of those things bear a commonality, but it's always simply the upright pole, the upright pillar of the tabernacle, and the upright posts of the doorway to life. There is no pagan cross associated with this, and it's like everything that Satan does. Satan is incapable of being creative, so he doesn't create religious imagery out of creativity. What he does is he takes an element of what God says and he twists it and corrupts it. So the upright pillar became a cross. The upright lintel of the doorway became the cross. So it's that's the basis of all of it.
Yeah, the Eden or upright pillar, foundation, tabernacle, exactly. You know, and I want to point this out. You know, you do a pretty spectacular job of explaining how Adonai, replaced the upright pillar. And I had it out.
Adon is written exactly the same in Hebrew as Edon.
Yeah, sure.
And 100% of the time that you see Edon in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, 100% of the time, God uses the term Edon to describe the upright pillar of the tabernacle.
Mm-hmm.
So, the upright one is a real important concept. And by the way, the really important concept is that Yosha represents the upright one. And, you know, to be with Yahweh, we need to be upright. You know, he lifts us up so we can stand with him. It's really important.
Yeah, he diminished himself to deal with us, so therefore we don't have to bow to him. He's the one that bent down
for
us
type of thing. Yeah, the upright one is important.
But I wanted to point this out, that you did a really good job of exposing where Adonai came from. And I was having it out with an intellectual who is studying his Torah, you know. And, basically what he does is studies what the Masoretes wrote, is all he really studies. But in Malachi, 1:12. Here's what it says. You got to love this. But you pierce him and you defile it with your boastful declarations. The table of my Eden is despised. His fruit is despised, is defiled, and his fruit is despised. Now, this is Yahweh's first person speaking. So we're to believe that he's calling somebody my Lord.
Yeah.
Right? If we're to take DN there and make it Adonai, who is Yahweh calling his Lord exactly?
Yeah, what Yahweh is saying is that my upright one, who is the diminished manifestation of Yahweh, the upright pillar that walked right out of the pages of the Torah, that's the one that man has come to despise.
Well, how's that to square away an intellectual? I mean, there it is, pure and simple.
Well, yeah.
I mean, who is it that exactly that God is calling my Lord? Hmm? Yeah.
Yeah.
And
why would
he went away?
Why would Ain Deleth Nun Edom be 100% of the time that those three letters appear in the Torah? Why would they be describing the upright pillar of the tabernacle? If in fact Eleth Nun meant Lord, you think this being
right.
Lord that's holding up the tabernacle, the upright pillar of the tabernacle, is really Lord? I mean, come on.
It's amazing, isn't it?
It's amazing. One of the things that was interesting is I was doing the translations of Psalm 91. One of the things I constantly came up with is that you are confronted with the opportunity to translate a word one way or another word, another way. And then so I just say, all right, so here's your opportunity. What are you going to do? And you can refute everything God's just said and negate his testimony and choose the religious translation. Or you can look at what does the word also mean and choose the rendering of the word that's consistent with what he just said. And why do people...
I go with the consistent one.
Right.
That
I do, too. God says he's consistent, so why don't we go with the consistent one? So it says, he will obtain the plague, an insult of the lowly and little one. His contemptuous and taunting slurs and rebuke will not be wiped away. Proverbs 6:33, we've been talking about the whore. He will obtain the plague, an insult of the lowly and little one. His contemptuous and taunting slurs of rebuke will not be wiped away. That's not just wiped away from Paul. I mean, I'm convinced that Yahweh is going to allow us to attend the trial of Paul. Can't wait. The plague of death, if Paul just condemning himself wouldn't be a plague, would it?
No.
So the reason it's called a plague here...
Because it spreads.
...is because it spreads. And this is the plague of the lowly and little one. This is the plague of Christianity. And he says the plague of Christianity, but Paul, is not going to be wiped away.
I find it interesting. It also means mark, because in the context of where we are now, eventually they're all going to be taking the mark, and then it's absolute death.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, that was interesting. As I was doing this too, I came across exactly the same thing that, and it's really true, and it's hard to miss in the 91st Psalm, that this plague that is associated with the lowly and little one, with Shaul, with Paul, is specifically taking the mark. So the mark of the beast is falling Christianity.
Yeah, I found that twice in this verse already. So
it sounds like they end up running the show. I mean, I had somewhat of a debate with Lisa about that one, where I think in the end it's Islam standing, but what's the difference? They're merging the two together, really.
Yeah,
so.
And here's my take on it, and it's. Your take is as good as mine, but I'll just share it with you. And I don't know what Lisa's point of view was, but here's mine.
Hers was that Christianity trumps it all in the end.
I think that the Coraline is going to have a Muslim father, a Christian mother, and he's going to be educated in a socialist, secular, humanist institution Oxford or Cambridge or Harvard or, other than birthplace, he's going to be identical to Muhammad, to Obama. You know, Obama had a Muslim father, a Christian mother, and he had a socialist, secular, humanist education. So
that's perfect.
That is right.
You could probably find him because now he'd be about 30 years old, so he's already been to Harvard if he went.
He's 30 years old and probably coming out of Macedonia someplace. But the issue is you think about the nature of that guy and his mark and the whole lot. It's pretty obvious that while he's going to be born embracing all three religions, I think he is, and he's going to try to bring those three religions together, very much like the Pope is trying to do now, like almost all religious people are doing, Rick Warren, who wrote Chrislam, this woman at UVA now who said we all worship the same God. They're going to try to bring the religions together. I think that Islam as a religion gets whacked. Maybe not completely destroyed, but darn near destroyed in the middle of the tribulation. So while he could embrace Islam and Christianity and bring it all together, the Magog War, man, it just devastates Islam. Now, there's still a little Islam left, but the Islam really, really takes a hit. I think in the range of 200 million Muslims are going to die. Now, there are 1.4 million Muslims on the planet today, so 200 million Muslims dying, doesn't completely obliterate the religion, but it's going to take a huge hit. And as part of the Magog War, what's left of the oil facilities in Saudi Arabia and the Gulf, they're torched, according to prophecy. I think that the principal religion of the Torahless One is Christianity. And I know that it's not written this way, but I think that when you study Paul is the Torahless One, being the plague of death, I think that the Torahless One is going to be identical to Paul. I think he's going to tout Christianity. So I think that the religion that stands at the end, when Ron Wyatt heard the Malach over the Ark of the Covenant say that he's going to raise the tablets that were etched in stone and emphasize the Shabbat when the Sunday law is imposed. Well, the Sunday law doesn't exist in Islam. The Sunday law exists in Christianity. So I think that if you view the Torahless One as Holy Pauline, I don't think you're going to be off by
that. Well, no, I mean, he clearly will be a Pauline Christian. I just think the two merge. I mean, they are busy doing that now,
Right.
It's okay to say Allah. It's not good to say Yahweh. In fact, it's banished now within the confines of the Catholic Church and has been for a few years now.
What you're saying about the merger is absolutely true. Absolutely true.
Yeah.
But I think it's also reasonable to point out that while God does have a lot of negative things to say about Islam, and particularly in Yeshaya 17, where he is describing them as terrorists flooding into Israel, and he himself is going to wipe them out, at least all that invade Israel.
And in Hosea, where he talks about the crescent moon invading your land as well.
Yeah. And so God hates Islam, and the Torahless One is going to be a jihadist, a man of war. And so he's going to embrace Islam. He's going to be popular in the Islamic world. The religion that God hates the most, the religion that is the plague of death, is Christianity. The Torahless One is going to primarily be a Christian more than anything.
He calls it the very power seat of Satan.
Seat of Satan. Yeah. Yes, you're right. The religions are going to merge. And whoever took the point of view that he's mostly going to be a Pauline Christian is right. Both are true.
No, it was Lisa that said that. And I said, I really don't know. Because in the end, when you look at Zach or Jan, they're screaming Allah.
There is nothing Babylonian about Islam. Other than, that the Quran was originally committed to paper in Babylon. And the
sun god, the moon god.
Yeah, the sun god. But the principle basis of Christianity is born and bred in Babylon. And its Trinity
yeah,
is Babylonian, dying and resurrecting God is Babylonian, Sunday worship is Babylonian, Lent is Babylonian, Easter, Christmas, all Babylonian. Even the term Bible, it's with Baal, Babel, Babylonian. So Christianity is the whore of Babylon that Yahweh says just prior to his return, come out of her, my people, he's speaking to Babylon. And when he says Babylon has fallen upon his return, the thing that is the most Babylonian, far and away, the thing that grew out of the beast of Rome is Roman Catholicism, is Christianity. So I think that principally what we're going to see is Christianity in the Torahless One. Because indeed, envy makes a human being venomous, hostile, and antagonistic. And he will not take pity or show mercy in the day of reckoning and payback. You have to wonder what caused Paul to be so venomous towards God. What caused Paul to be so egotistical? What caused Paul to denounce everything that God said? What caused Paul to be so hostile to the Torah, to the covenant, to the chosen people?
Says envy.
And that God's saying, here is envy.
Yeah.
It's envy.
Isn't that one of the seven deadly sins Paul writes about, I think?
Yeah, I don't know. I think that's Roman Catholicism. But
whatever.
Envy, God is saying, is the thing that makes the human being venomous. And Paul wanted to be the Messiah. He wanted to be the savior of his religion. Paul wanted to be the author of his religion. He wanted to replace God. Paul and Satan, you know, what is it that caused Satan to fall? He envied God's relationship with man. He envied God. He wanted to be above God. That's envy. So Paul shares Satan's persona. That's what God's saying here, that the envy that caused Satan to be who he was is the same envy that ultimately caused Paul to be who he is. So Satan and Paul are one and the same. He is essentially unwilling to actually accept or endure any compensation, ransom, payment, or appeasement. And he is unwilling to yield. And therefore, he will refuse to accept you, no matter how great and numerous your gifts or influence. Doesn't matter how good you are. Doesn't matter how many you've donated to charity. You can't buy God. He's not impressed with your money or your goodness. Boy, that sure shoots the living tar out of the entire contributions, donations, tithes, offerings, and the indulgences.
Wow.
God said, you know, I created a path to my home, and it's free. I'm offering it to you free. If you think you can buy me, you're insulting me. Go away. I can't be bought. Can't be influenced with goodness or money or donations or philanthropy. I do not care.
Say it one more time, everybody. You can't be influenced by money.
You cannot be influenced by money or by your good deeds. You're not going to buy favor with God for great donations or for being a good person or for all of the donations that you have made. You can't influence him.
Right.
He can't be bought. You got to be right. He offered a path to him that is absolutely free. He paid the price. When you try to buy him, to influence him with your goodness and your donations, you're insulting him. Your goodness is a filthy rag from his perspective, and he has no use of your money. Your money has got all sorts of negatives associated with it. He's the one who enriches. You can't enrich him. Well, you can enrich him. Yeah, actually, you can enrich him. You can't do it with money.
His family.
Yeah, you can enrich him through, you know, when you come to see insights in his testimony, you're enriching him. When you engage in the covenant relationship, you're enriching him. The more wonderful people that are part of his family, he's enriched. So, yeah, we can enrich God, but sure as hell can't do it with money.
Yeah.
God can't be bought. can't be influenced. You know, you could be the Roman Catholic Church with 1.4 billion adherents and hundreds of billions of dollars in wealth and all these magnificent edifices around the world, and God said, nah, it doesn't mean squat to me. I can't be bought. Not going to impress me with your Vatican. You know, America thinks it's a great superpower, and you know, it has all these great possessions and all this wealth. And God says, nah, no. It means nothing to me. It doesn't hold one iota of influence. It's all about being right, not being good. Well, you know what? This puts us in a perfect position to start Psalm 91 next week. I do love Psalm 91. Now, Larry, I was told that Jackie sent you Psalm 91. The chapter is not complete because I have not yet translated Numbers 5. I'm in the midst of doing that now. And I'm going to put Numbers 5 at the end of it. Psalm 91 is complete, and I did send that. I had Jackie send it to you. We're trying to keep one set of files so we just don't have different versions everywhere, and I'm trying to figure out which is the latest version. So,
Are you going to cover any of 7?
Just finished translating. Actually, I'm 3 verses from finished translating 7, and then I'm going to write the commentary. And then because 7 is so fixated on the whore, I'm definitely going to translate Yahshua Isaiah 14, where Satan is associated with Babylon. And so I've got some, still got some work to do before that chapter 5 is done. And I haven't done any of the commentary. All I've done is just translated all but, I think, I'm within 2 or 3 verses of completing the translation for Proverbs 7. Okay. My biggest challenge right now in Proverbs 7 is there's a section of it which reverts to first person in the middle of it. And what I don't know is it God saying, you know, I did all these things and I tried to reach out to you and you chose the whore instead? Or is it whore saying...
Say holy. He did say lowly and little over here, so he was talking about Paulos. I mean, there's no question about
completely
that.
The whore is associated with Paulos in Romans, in Proverbs 6 and Proverbs 7. There's no question about that. Here is the lowly and little one, and in Proverbs 7, it's actually named Sheol. But there's a spot in the middle of it where it reverts to first person, and I don't know if that is the whore trying to seduce, or Yahweh saying, yeah, I was there for you, but you chose the whore instead, or maybe it's both, and you're and depending on which one you choose, that's the one that is reaching out to you. So I've got a little work to do on that to figure out who is speaking. There's like 4 or 5 lines.
Which verse is it in Yahshua Yah that he talks about the lowly little one yet again?
In Yahshua Yah. In Yahshua Yah, he actually uses the name Sheol, Shaul. He calls him by his name. And I will find it for you, because that's one of the things I've got to do. There's once in Yahshua Yah that he's specific. In fact, I've done 90%. It's a whole chapter that's devoted to Pauline Christianity, and I've done 80% of the translation, and I just haven't finished it. So I've got to finish the translation there, and I'll send it to you once I finish it. And that it came actually from William the Elevator Man, is the one that found that and sent it to me, and I've done most of the translation. And I was going to make that chapter 6 of observations. And then in Hosha, there's right in the middle of Hosha, he's talking about, you know, the religious infidelity of Israel, of Ephraim. He references Shaul as the plague of death. And that's really interesting. I'd always thought that the religion that Yahweh was condemning in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms was Judaism. But Judaism didn't exist until about the 1st century BCE. And so these things were all written between 500 and 1,000, or 500 to 1,400 BCE. So the religion that is being condemned isn't Judaism. And the description of the religion is most similar to Roman Catholicism today. So the
They were already involved in trash similar to that all the way back then. So it's awful when I hear people say, you know, well, this is what they did back then, and this is what the tradition is. I think, why would you want to imitate a tradition from a bunch of people that don't know Yahweh? He tells us explicitly not to do that. And this is not an attack on Jews, by the way. I mean, they're just as confused as everybody else on the planet. This is certainly not an attack on. I do not like doing that for several reasons, but still, I mean, it's just that the group, the bulk of the family, was hopelessly lost thousands of years ago. And they've never got it back together as a collective whole.
And they won't until 2033.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Now, God doesn't have anything good to say about the religious behavior of Israel, but most of what he has to say about the religious behavior is more indicting of Christianity than it is Judaism.
I know.
Because the only thing he says negative of Judaism would be found in Matanyah. Because Judaism exists at the time the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms is revealed.
He's actually reaching out to all these goy, asking them to wake up.
Right.
And because it's important to him that everybody.
But you look at Yirmiyah, the things in Yirmiyah that are condemned are Easter. They're rallying around the Eshtar pole. Easter. The basis of Roman Catholicism with the Mother of God, Queen of Heaven, Madonna and Child with Astarte. The whole concept of Christmas, of Sunday worship, and the Christian New Testament, all of those things are destroyed in Yirmiyah. So the religion that is pummeled in Yirmiyah is not Judaism, it's Christianity.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and it takes a real buffoon to sit there and read this stuff, especially when it describes the Christmas tree so perfectly.
There's only one beast that grew out of the Roman Empire. Only one.
Yeah,
the Christianity. That spread upon the whole world. Roman Catholicism.
Christianity. Yep.
Christianity.
And, of course, as a Christian, I always said, well, you know, those Catholics are evil, but I'm a Christian. Yeah. That's different.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. But there is no Christianity without Roman Catholicism.
No, of course not.
No. I mean,
you had to have the Council of Nicaea.
The entirety of the religion for the first, I don't know what, probably
around 1500,
800,
1100 years.
It wasn't until the Crusades that Eastern Orthodox Christianity separated from Roman Catholicism, because if you look at Roman Catholicism, it wasn't created in Rome. It was created in Ephesus. It was created in Constantinople. It was the Theodosius who imposed it, was an emperor of what was at the time known as the Eastern Roman Empire. So Eastern Orthodox Christianity and Roman Catholicism are exactly the same beast. And they did separate during the Crusades because the Eastern Orthodox Church was being hammered by Islam long before the Roman Catholic Church. Right. So that's when there was a split of the two. But prior to 1100, there was just one Christianity, and it was Roman Catholicism. And that was it. There wasn't any Christianity other than that. So,
Roman Catholicism, there is no Christianity. Eastern Orthodox, the same animal. They just claim not to be under the Pope. I mean, that's the end of that.
And the Anglican Church, which is the beginning of Protestantism. And Anglican Church is a variation, as is the Episcopal Church. That's a variation of Roman Catholicism, too. Very Orthodox.
Yeah, it all is.
I just didn't want to say
it all is.
Yeah.
Anytime you got crosses involved and a Lord involved or anybody other than Yahweh, no worship at all in the seven Moed Mikra, you're into something else entirely different than what Yahweh supports and advances. So call yourself anything you want.
Overlap between Protestant Christianity and Roman Catholicism. About 90%
sure.
overlap.
Sure.
Funny how they won't bow. Christians won't bow down to a statue, yet they'll go to Washington and revere these godlike men that they make into Abraham Lincoln and Thomas Jefferson, and I mean they just go giddy. So.
Well, but you know, Protestant Christians are bowing down all the time. And you know they've all got their pagan crosses and on top of and in front of their churches.
Hey, yeah, and they wear them around the neck just like everybody else.
Right, and they're all bowing down in prayer. Mm-hmm. Now they won't bow down to a statue of Mary, but their churches are filled with religious.
Bow down to the
images.
Cross up on the big on the dais of there too.
So, right.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, there is no cross.
People.
Only cross
By the way, even that the idea of the Christian cross is that that symbol, which was the name for Tammuz, which is where its origin came from, but the actual implement of Roman crucifixion was not a Christian cross. It was an upright pole that stayed in the ground, and then there was a horizontal piece that was set on top of it. But the idea of the Christian cross, the image of a Christian cross, was never used.
It didn't even exist.
It didn't even exist.
No.
The artist, unfortunately, my crowd figured that out and brought that to your face all the time.
Yeah. You'd see the fixed to an upright pole, and that horizontal beam was just set right on top of it and was lodged so that it would set right on top, and it was not nailed in place, and that the implement the Christians have tattooed on them, and it is the symbol of the religion that never existed. And why would you pick... I mean, just think, why would you pick an implement of death and torture as a symbol of your religion?
Well, if you were HaSatan, you'd do that, wouldn't you?
Of course.
Because you really want to show how stupid man is, that they literally, you know, it's like the worship of death. That's what it is.
It's the worship
of death.
It's a death cult.
Yes, it is a death cult. They call us a cult, by the way. You know, there's not one of the people in the chat room that, you know, are regulars or an unpopular truth or us that haven't been called a cult member. And of course, you kind of defined a cult as you got to have a leader, you got to have some kind of building, you got
to
be somehow raping people
money.
In their labor.
Right.
Yeah, their labor somehow or another. I mean, I don't know
of
anything.
You've got a keychain, you've got a lot of stuff. We got none of it.
Right. I mean, you know, all I know is I'm not going to say I've lost money. I'm sure Yahweh's taking care of me quite well. But I don't, and in some pride needs to be said, Kirk, you don't get paid to do any of this. You shell out, don't you, for this radio time?
And
I don't get paid. I just, you know, I mean, there's no earthly paycheck for any of us.
Not like don't we?
None of us.
We wouldn't take it if it was offered.
I've actually been offered money and said, and I've blocked people for that. I say, are you kidding me?
You're kidding me. Yeah.
You know.
Okay, guys. Here's Webster's: a cult is a system of religious worship or rites and ceremonies. Is from cultus in the Latin to worship. And we talk about worship today, don't exist in any word that we know.
Yeah. God,
we disparage any form of worship.
We're anti-religion and anti-worship.
Anti-worship,
you can't be a cult when you're anti-religion. Yeah, since cult means to worship and to be religious, and we're anti-religious and anti-worship, that would be the antithesis, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Although Christianity would be a cult then by that definition, wouldn't it?
Absolutely.
cult of
death. Yeah, from the largest sun cult in the world to be called a cult.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing. But that's the world standing on its head. You know, it's like that's people walk up to us and they're walking on their hands. You know what I'm saying? And we're standing there on our feet. And they're talking to us, and we're looking at them thinking, don't you realize you have all this, you know, back ass words? What's going on here, man? Don't you get it? You know, I mean, it's all upside down. You got to straighten yourself out there. You got to get docked. You got to stand up, pal. You know, it just doesn't happen that easy.
The dock doesn't just mean right. It means upright.
Upright.
Yes, upright. Right.
Right.
Yeah. They're upside down.
Yeah, it was to be upright.
Yeah.
But isn't that what Satan would really want? I mean, you asked that, sir. That's exactly
what he wants. But think about how powerful that is. How powerful that is.
I know.
The word for being right with God means to be upright. So you cannot be right with God if you're bowed down.
No, you can't
be. The antithesis.
Bowing like
right.
a monkey.
Right.
You're a monkey then.
But if you're standing up in God's presence, if you understand the idea that you stand with him, alongside him and with him and walk with him, then you're well on your way to being right.
And it's not even in a warrior capacity. It's in a straightforward, upright manner, serious capacity, showing people this is rational, this is how it works, there's a being. And, you know, even when we use the word spiritual sometimes, I was thinking about this. You know, why not say, amplified dimensionally or interdimensional force or something like that. I mean, even spiritual, the way they've taken it to this level now has just become goofy, you know.
Right.
So many religious overtones on it. But just interdimensional, he's an interdimensional being. You know, I mean, somebody has to be above a creation, as was pointed out, in order to create a dimension.
You cannot create a four-dimensional construct. And, of course, the universe is at least four-dimensional unless you're in the fifth dimension. Can't be done.
Right. We
and
can,
and then it's obvious that the universe also has, as the preponderance of it, dark matter and dark energy. And that represents 96% of the universe, and that our universe is space-time, there's at least six dimensions. And so this whole idea of 6 plus 1 being Yahweh's formula, he's clearly a seven-dimensional being. He cannot create a seven-dimensional universe. He can create in the seventh dimension, but to create an entire universe, it has to be in the six dimensions. And so the universe is six-dimensional because he's in the seventh dimension. And he can't create an eight-dimensional universe, for example. And
when you
know,
start
that's not
figuring, though,
the
differences.
Yeah, not much of a limitation because just going from stuck in time as we are in three dimensions in a four-dimensional universe, stuck in time, just being liberated in time is an infinite expansion of our power and capability. And then to go from the fourth dimension to the fifth is another infinite increase. And so it's an infinity times infinity. And then to go from five to six is an infinite increase. And then from six to seven is an infinite increase. And so you've got infinity times infinity times infinity times infinity times infinity is the increase that we're going to experience going from three and a half dimensions to seven.
Well, is it any reason he couldn't have an eighth dimension and he's just working in the seventh?
Yeah, because he's seven-dimensional. In seven dimensions, he can't have an eighth. He can't do anything. It's just like, okay, you are a three-dimensional being. Why don't you try to create a piece of art that is, or anything, that is four-dimensional?
No, I'm understanding that if I'm here, I can't do that, but I mean, he could
be
if
you're in the seventh dimension, you can't even conceive of eight dimensions, much less create in it. Impossible. Roy's right. I mean, don't feel uncomfortable putting limitations on God. God puts all sorts of limitations on himself. And understand that going from three and a half dimensions to seven dimensions is, these are all, each increment up is an infinite multiplier.
Yeah, well, it was part of infinity.
It's beyond comprehension where we're going in terms of the capacity and the enrichment and the empowerment we're going to have. But, if there weren't limits, then there would be no sense to anything. There have to be limits.
Yeah, that would make sense.
So, no, Yahweh cannot create an eighth-dimensional construct. Can't do it, and there's no reason for him to do it. And so we're going to enjoy seven dimensions, and we're going to enjoy six-dimensional universes.
I don't even, I don't know that anybody could properly describe, what even a fourth dimension is like, much less a fifth or all the way to the seventh.
Yeah, what the fourth dimension essentially enables is it does two things. It makes us eternal. So there's no limit on the most finite resource we have right now is time. That resource becomes infinite. And so our most limited resource is replaced with something that is infinite. That's part of the empowerment and enrichment. But the second thing is that by being taken and having full capacity in the fourth dimension, it means that a universe that is some 30 billion light years across, from its center to the edges is 15 billion light years. And so that means that from one end to the other is 30 billion light years across. That a universe that large, you couldn't, so long as you're material, stuck in time, you could never endure the time.
You could never cross it. No,
right.
No,
you couldn't even go to the next galaxy. You can't even explore the stars in your own galaxy. But all of a sudden, when you're infinite in time and you become like light, then the method of measuring speed, which is distance over time, if time becomes irrelevant under those circumstances, then there is no issue of speed and therefore ability to transition great distances. You can instantly be wherever you want to be. And so it's stunningly important to go from 3.5 dimensions to fully 4-dimensional. It replaces the most finite resource we have right now with time, and it enables us to enjoy the entirety of the universe. And by being an energy-based entity, it also means that we can also investigate the inner workings of matter and energy, and because we have a universe that's retreating inwardly as magnificently as it's retreating outwardly.
Talking about just infinity. I mean, for real. I mean, all things considered. And then, again, you're only getting to the fourth. And when you start talking about going up to the fifth and sixth and getting into the seventh, I doubt if we have any words or concepts or imaginations that can even pretend to describe it.
Yeah.
We
understand that it's the four-dimensional universe at the very least, and we can at least envision some of the benefits of being liberated in time. But
we can't envision the fifth dimension.
There's no one alive that can envision five dimensions. We're just incapable of it. So, no, I can't tell you what it's going to be like to be a seven-dimensional construct. Sounds really appealing. I understand the math of it. I can't tell you.
Wow.
Yeah, like it's all exponential and infinite times.
Yeah, but I do think that it's going to have a structure to it. I think that we're still going to observe the Shabbat. I think we're still going to observe the Mekrim.
I think it's probably the math and all of it, don't you think?
Right. I think what we're going to do is we're going to have at our disposal at least one and maybe multiple six-dimensional universes. One would be sufficient, but maybe we're going to, because, going and exploring it together is more fun than having your own. I'd much rather share a six-dimensional universe with you guys than having my own, much rather. But, you know, whatever I guess whatever we want, we get to have. But we are going to go off and do our thing. But time is still going to flow and matter to Yahweh, and we're still going to come back and on the Shabbat.
Meeting times.
Yeah, meeting time and talk about what we explored. Because
and it's Shabbat.
No matter how magnificent something is, it's still better when you share it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well,
so that's so we have a little bit of insights here and there, but I, you know, for the most part,
yeah. It's fun to speculate, though.
It is fun to speculate. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Well, it's just beyond, you know, any real speculation because. I'm just saying this just because, you know, our minds can't fathom and how spectacular. I mean, just getting into the fourth dimension, I mean, that's just totally spectacular. It's spectacular.
Spectacular. Yeah, I can't even.
I mean.
I would be satisfied, quite frankly. I'd be absolutely satisfied, tickled to death, to be a four-dimensional, fully functional, four-dimensional, energy-based construct. Because what you could do in this universe and the things you could see and explore and the time you'd have to do it. So magnificent, it was just four-dimensional.
Yeah, and again, you talk about it's retreating in as fast as it's moving out, and so then, I mean, you can get down to, you know, microorganisms, you know, type
of stuff.
You can see
what makes up a quark and what makes up a lepton.
Yeah, there you go. That's right. Really getting down there, you know. Yeah,
right.
You're inside a quark and it becomes the size of a football stadium or something, you know. And you're,
right.
What?
Right.
Right. I mean.
Yeah. And then there's going to be something that's a packet of energy somehow that is used to comprise the quarks and leptons, and they're all going to be in their various colors and shades.
Okay.
It's going to be a magnificent thing, and then the way that they form together to create different forms of energy and matter. It's going to be beautiful. The things we're going to be able to see and perceive and understand and enjoy. You know, like right now, we can see a tiny, tiny sliver of light. You know, all we really see is visible light. Well, visible light represents an entire, that really tiny part of that energy-based spectrum of waves, you know, from
even visible light, you can discern all the visible rays of light. I heard in shades. I heard if you know, I'm sitting here in Jacksonville, Florida, and if I took a picture of a movie reel, if you will, film, and I run it all the way to say Minneapolis, Minnesota, and all the way back down here, and that represents like all the colors in the spectrum. We can see 3 inches of that or something.
Right.
Whoa. Yeah. And maybe colors have feelings. I mean, we make us feel certain ways, you know, and all these things. Well, I'm sure they do. And
well,
so
colors, they're emotional when you look at you people react to.
Well, you know, you look at the Hubble pictures of nebula and galaxies and all that kind of thing. That are all colored.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're colored to reflect different wavelengths of light that we can't see.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that they aren't really that color to the naked eye. No, it's, you know, gamma rays or some other form of radiation is colored to create something that we can see and perceive. So, you know, we're going to be able to see all of that, you know, not just the 3 inches of it.
I'm just saying the whole thing becomes astounding. And we're only at level 4 from 3.5. I mean, whoa.
You know, just that would be enough to be entertained for eternity.
Forever. Yeah.
Right.
And then you're going to have different, I'm sure you're going to have different types of feelings. And then, you know, imagine just having the feeling of ultimate power. I mean, just of incredible, immense power that we can't imagine today. I mean, just that.
That's why I'm really happy that we're going to have the Torah instructions written inside of us. You wouldn't want to screw up with that, would you?
No, I wouldn't. And I'm, I mean, you're going to have those guidelines, and it would have to be inculcated as a part of your being. Otherwise,
you're right.
It would advantage or misuse,
of course,
or whatever.
Right. Yeah, because we're still going to have free will. So we want to make certain that with the things that we're doing are productive and beneficial and not destructive. Now, you can't destroy our nature But, you know, you could, I'm sure that things that we could do with that much power that would be destructive of the universe, and we don't want to do that.
Yeah, amongst other things, making mistakes inside.
I want the guidelines.
And it's not even just that. It's you know, how do we produce more and produce more and produce more? You know, there's a whole lot of things that go into having that power. Forget destructive abilities.
I also think it's not just the guidelines as to what you should and shouldn't do. I also think it's the explanation, so that you're looking at something, and the teaching and the directions help us understand what we're looking at.
Yeah, and we don't, I don't, you know, even at this point, we don't have to be geniuses to follow, you know, the directions. I mean, it's like, Raquel said there's a beast inside of me. Benjamin was born,
right.
Killed her, and then Benjamin's first son was named Adar, and then it ends up being tied to Molech, and the sun at high noon, and all the rest. And you start looking at these things and you say, wow, you know, it's all right there in front of us, right?
And right.
It's all there.
Then
it turns out Paulos was a Benjamite, right. and all these things. And you know, this is with our really finite minds.
Right.
I mean, some of us might grasp it more than others. I mean, you know, you guys may have a better grasp on it than I do, but I mean, I'm a simple guy like me. I can get that, you know.
I think our grasp right now is very similar. It's just like the Roy story. Roy does a better job of understanding initially the concept of the seven dimensions, but once he explains it, we're all right on the same page.
Yeah, I mean, true, and everybody breaks out different pieces and connects different dots, and that's the beauty, again, I mean, of having, you know, different people from different races and different places, you know, and our own insights and perceptions that we're sharing with one another.
Yeah, I want to, you know,
what
you look like, what Kirk looks like is irrelevant. What we are like is relevant. The fact that we're going to bring a perspective and acumen and attitude and all that kind of stuff with us, and that's going to make the whole experience richer.
And more productive and more fun.
Yeah.
I mean, anytime you're out there by yourself, that's not a lot of fun.
No,
I mean, really.
I want a different perspective. I want somebody I can talk to and.
I mean, you even think about the genius of reaching in from seven dimensions to have a relationship with a creation that is, you know, less than an ant to us. I mean, really, less than an ant. You know,
well, look at the difference between Mickey Mouse and Walt Disney.
Yeah. I mean, and then
two dimensions versus three. Right.
Yeah.
Mickey Mouse versus Walt Disney. And that's the difference between going in any one of those steps. It's infinite.
Pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, if you were Flatland, if you were a being in Flatland in two dimensions, you would have no ability whatsoever to understand what was in three dimensions.
Yeah.
You couldn't even envision it.
Even the ones Kirk paints, I think.
That is correct. Even the Kirkster couldn't do it.
Kirk.
That's just why I said, Kirk, I don't care how much talent you have, you cannot create a four-dimensional piece of art.
Yeah.
Then you got the flat Earth. You know, that's a new thing going on, the flat Earth theory. I like that one. That's
a
lot
of
where people end up going.
So that's,
they got a new one. Yes, they do. It's all over FB. I mean, and I always agree with them and say, yeah, that's how, you know, of course, you know, when pilots fly around the world, I wonder how that works, you know.
Yeah.
And then I say, you know, of course, I realize that it's probably true because there are a lot of people that go missing and they probably went up to the edge and fell in. And you know, that's if you ever see the edge because nobody's ever seen it and come back.
Yeah. How do you deal with this, and then end up on, just keep on going if it's not a sphere? I don't know. I'm curious about being stuck in the mud.
How do you deal with that?
I don't know how you sail around the Earth anymore. I don't get it. You know, it's flat. You know, I don't know. And then these pilots that, yeah, like, flew around, you know, first guy to ever fly around the planet, things like that. It's, yep, they're out there. The flat earthers, they're really out there.
Wow.
They are out there, too.
Yeah. For the things that people will believe.
Anything but the truth, huh?
Yeah, it's laughable. You know, well, I mean, the same people that got to whip out the book of Hancock on you, you know. I mean, it's like that.
I can't wait to do Hancock. It's,
of course. I mean, it's got all these contradictions to the Torah book.
I will tell you that the spirit that inspired Enoch is the same spirit that inspired the Quran.
Yeah, and Paul.
Yeah.
I said that. I said they sound a lot alike, these campfire stories, you know, with the
shaking
animals. And,
Paul has his, in the Quran, he's got his Adam that's miles tall.
Just you mean Muhammad?
Giants, that are miles tall. Yeah, Muhammad has Adam as being miles tall.
He's a cavalry leader. Those are some big horses, too. Where did they come from? You know, the skeletons and all that. And I've had people show me these skeletons. You know, it's, you know, there's a, you know, obviously there's an app these days. What's it called, you guys, where you can make anything in a picture.
What is it? Oh, I know what you're talking about, though.
Photoshop. So you Photoshop a guy standing by some skeleton, and you make the head, you know, 30 yards long or something like that. And they go, what do you mean? It's all over the internet. And I ask them, you ever hear of Photoshop? I mean, do you realize if there was a giant that was 1,000 feet tall or something, you know, that would be like the big story of like the decade? Do you not get that?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, if it really was, if even there was a, first of all, I don't think the structure of animals, I think that the dinosaurs are about as big as you're ever going to get. Let's just say that there was proof that
from a physiological standpoint, they would walk and it would just break in half because of all the weight.
It'd be the biggest story in the of all time.
Yeah.
Biggest story of all time.
And by the way, I to this day, I believe that Bigfoot is the king of hide and go seek. What do you think of that?
The world needs another show on finding Bigfoot.
I've watched a few of them. They're so hilarious. These guys, it's a religion. It is. It's a religion.
Yeah, it is.
And it's a laughable religion. They actually get
and
shot.
And always, they're always out there. It's just missed it. Just missed it. It was right here.
Well, they got this gang of hillbillies. It's a real shtick. Everybody, one's a hunter and one's a trapper. I've watched two of them, and I go, oh, God. And they're always after, you know, like the goat man of Humboldt County or whatever, you know. And, you know, they got corn cob pipes, and they're all carrying 10-gauge shotguns and everything, and they're out there. And the thing just falls apart. Boom, there he is. The camera gets knocked over and all this. And it's like, if you came that close to catching him, wouldn't you go back next week and get him? I mean, bring the National Guard or something.
Your deal here, this is, there's so few of them that no one's ever seen one, and you're you out with your gun so you can shoot it.
Couldn't it be a male and a female around there somewhere?
It's gotta be big feet.
It's everything. Yeah, well, you know what? There was a guy that claimed to kill one. Now, this is no kidding. This is actually very hilarious. And apparently, he was hated among the Bigfoot community because it was supposedly two adolescents with their dad or whatever. Mm. Maybe it was their mom. Or with their dad. And he was up in the high country there in California. He shot one dead, and it was a baby, and the baby looked at him with a tear and held his hand while it died. And after he did it, he said he felt bad that he had done it. And so what did he do to prove
the baby Bigfoot that he shot. What did he do? And this is a guy that was hated in the Bigfoot community. He did what you would naturally do. He took the body and he buried it to come back and get it later. Even though he's got a hunting truck, and you know, as far as I know, it's not against the law to shoot a Bigfoot, you know, or anything like
there's
that.
There's no season on Bigfoot.
Yeah, right, there's no season on
Bigfoot.
It's like killing a shrimp, I guess, you know. And so that's what you do. You bury it and come back in the spring to get the body for whatever reason. And when it comes back, all there is a little hair left because obviously the animals got to it. So he kept his hairs. And there's a guy from England that came over and did the DNA on 18 of these clowns that have these hairs. And they range from dog to wild boar to horse to cow to wolf. Hairs, and there may have been something else in there, but guess what? None of them was a Bigfoot.
Oh,
and you should see their faces when they tell them, sorry, it came back negative, pal.
I'm so sorry. Wow. Yeah, no.
It's like telling a Christian Paul's a loser. You know, you just can't do it. They're right back at it next week. I'm telling you.
Yeah, I'm back at it, man. The most interesting critter ever made was a platypus, so I'm just glad they're
making it's hard to debate that. I don't even know what they're for. I mean, they must have a purpose.
Roy said he has one on his property, and he's going to try to catch it or get a picture of it, at least a real good picture, so you can see how wonderful it is.
Okay.
He has one on his farm.
Okay, well, we're going to go and we're going to
maybe he can shoot it. and bring it back next
because I want to have a cult of the platypus. It's a sacred species. Don't be shooting.
There are not many of them around, I know that.
I don't know.
All right, maybe he's lying to us. I want to see a picture of it at least.
I'm going to go get my Bigfoot gear.
Meet again. You're going to start on 91st on next
91,
week?
91, yeah.
91, I mean?
Yep.
Yes. Okay.
Yep.
All righty, I'll be there with bells on.
No, okay.
Well, it's always great to start Shabbat out with the family. I love it. And you guys,
I love
you guys.
Yeah. That's right, guys, really fun. Yep.
Me too.
Good time. Big
night, y'all.
Good night.